This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we talk about the social lives of children. The ups and downs of kids' friendships include the joy of play and sharing secrets. They also include betrayals, teasing, and bullying. Psychologist and former seventh grade teacher Michael Thompson is our guest this afternoon. Michael Thompson is one of the authors of the new book, Best Friends, Worst Enemies, Understanding the Social Lives of Children. His co-authors are Catherine O'Neill Grace and Lawrence Cohen. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged. Join the discussion with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to his work as a clinical psychologist, Dr. Thompson is a lecturer, consultant, and the author of two previous books, Speaking of Boys and Raising Cain. Dr. Michael Thompson conducts workshops on social cruelty, children's friendships, and boys' development. He's the father of two children, a daughter and a son. He and his wife live in Massachusetts. Again, our telephone number is 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Thompson, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm really fine. Thank you.
Good, good. Your book is a joy to read, and it's chock full of really good information. I want to start talking at the top here, talking about child development and how we develop friends. And I was surprised to learn that even though I have noticed that kids are very interested in one another from a very young age, I wasn't aware that friendship or connection is possible in babies. What can you tell us about these very early relationships?
Yeah, as soon as a baby can crawl, they have a choice of other babies, they make a friendship choice. That is, they will crawl more consistently to one child, and they will smile more. They're not really able to play yet, but they'll greet each other more warmly, maybe hand each other things, and they will do that very consistently. I visited a daycare center, and there was a little boy there who was there 5 days a week, and a little girl that he liked. These were kids just over a year old. The girl he liked was there only 3 days a week, and the teacher said that he was noticeably sad on the 2 days when his little buddy wasn't there.
Hmm. What is it about kids? It seems that they recognize in one another that they are alike in ways that they're not alike in terms of themselves and their parents or adults.
Yeah, no, big people look very different to kids, you know? We are in some ways a different species.
Yeah.
And a friend, somebody your own size, a peer, can make you, wants to play with things you want to play with and is interested in things that are interesting to you and can make you feel good. I mean, children can enhance each other's self-esteem in a way that we can't. I mean, I can say to my daughter, Joanna, you know, you're beautiful, you're talented. She's glad to have her dad say these things. But if she walks into a room and her friend Aaron Clare says, Joanna, where'd you get that jacket? That's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, boom. Her feelings about herself, her stock goes right up.
When do children begin to develop a close friendship with another child?
Well, there's a lot of variety. I
mm-hmm.
mean, some children are involved for longer in their mother as their closest friend. And your friendship with your parents is your first friendship. You learn a lot about mutuality and reciprocity and play and sharing a laugh. These kinds of things you learn with a parent in the early going. And then your parent lets you move away. And some children are bolder, and some children are a little more on the shy side. So there's a lot of variation. I mean, my daughter, when we went to pick her up at daycare, we could hardly peel her out of the place. And my son, was much more ready to come home. He was done enough, and he's that way to this day.
Yeah, and some kids take to daycare or to kindergarten immediately, and other kids, you know, stand there at the door crying from mom and dad.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Although, though, as heartbreaking as that is, you know, usually 15 minutes after you've gone, they're hanging out with other kids and have forgotten all about you.
Yeah. Well, it's the same with a babysitter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they need to let you know how central and important you are, but after they've registered their message, they move on.
Yeah, and the babysitter can be fun and cool.
Right.
When do kids begin to talk about, you know, close friends or best friends? When does that relationship begin to develop?
Now, don't you remember that in fifth or sixth grade, Celeste? Do you remember having a number one best friend?
I think it started actually a little earlier.
Uh-huh. When for you? Was it third or fourth, or was it real early? Did you have a close buddy of the heart before second grade?
Well, I do remember one girl from kindergarten very fondly,
uh-huh,
who was actually an outcast, and I couldn't understand why, and, you know, she didn't look so much like the rest of us, but I found out that I really liked her a lot.
Right.
So I remember that, but we weren't really friends because, you know, at that age, it's hard to navigate two blocks, you know,
right,
by yourself. So only in school and at social party situation kind of things did we interact. But I think by third grade, I had a very close friend.
Right. And not all children do. And, again, you have to understand there's individual variation. There are kids who just hook up right away, and they're kind of friends of the heart and inseparable in kindergarten. And then there are 14-year-olds who've never had that very close friend of the heart. And the mothers come up to me at the end of my talk and say, well, now you've said friends are so important, but my son doesn't have a best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, does he have kids he hangs around with at school? Does he play on teams? Yes, yes, yes. Does he seem happy? Yes. He comes home on weekends and plays with his brother. And I said, it's fine. What I'm hearing is fine. There is a variation. 85% of kids are going to be okay because they have a friend or two at a minimum. An average elementary school child has five friends. And then there's some kids, you know, who just have an appetite for mobs. And they're always with a big group. But what I'm worried about is the 15% of kids at the bottom of the heap who are either controversial or rejected by their classmates. Those kids may be forbidden, if you will, from having a friend because the cool kids cast them out so far that nobody can reach out to them. The way you did to your little outcast friend, you liked her.
Yeah.
But in the later grades, the popular kids can say, you know, don't be her friend. She's a dork.
Yeah.
You know, if you're her friend, you're a dork too.
Well, thinking back on this, it's interesting because there was a group dynamic going at that age in that situation. However, somehow or other, now later, of course, I very much was involved with a group. And, you know, as adults, we're involved in groups. But at that age, the group opinion wasn't that important to me.
No. No, it's later on, as we begin to feel ourselves more grown up and move away and transform our relationship with our families, that then the group becomes a kind of second family.
Mm.
And Ron Taffel, a psychologist, has written a book about teenage groups by that name, the second family. But you then all of a sudden the group becomes very high stakes for you, very high stakes. And what they think and how they dress is crucial because those are your people now.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a moment ago kids who are, you called, controversial or rejected.
Right.
These are kids that might not have anybody they can call a friend, or no one will call them friend.
Right.
What does it mean to be, what are these labels mean, controversial? And rejected is pretty clear, but what about controversial?
Well, can I go to the top and just outline? This is
sure.
John Cooey's research from Duke University. Top 15% of a class, very popular. The next 45% is accepted. Then you have 20% of kids who are ambiguous or unclassifiable. That's because the way the research is done, they don't get a lot of popular votes, but they don't get negative hits either. So you've got 15 and 45 and 20, you've got 80% of kids who are okay. Why are they okay? Because they have a friend. Then the bottom 20% is made up of neglected, controversial, and rejected kids. Neglected kids tend to be very studious, shy. They come to school to do schoolwork, not make friends. And they may get overlooked in elementary school, but by the end of elementary school, neglected kids usually have a friend. So the moment they have a friend, from a psychologist's point of view, they're out of serious harm's way. Controversial kids have characteristics that the groups like, but they also have characteristics that the group just drives the other kids nuts. I run into it all the time with ADHD boys with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder,
mm-hmm.
and they're so verbally impulsive, and other boys like their energy and their recklessness, but they can't keep their mouth shut. They blurt out secrets. The teacher's giving out homework that she gave out before, and all the kids are sitting there thinking, if we don't tell her, we'll tell her tomorrow, we'll have no homework tonight. And he's the kid that says, but you gave us this last week, you know what I mean? And all the other kids grab their heads and think, why can't he shut up? Or girls, I see it very often, you get a very verbally facile and kind of socially powerful girl in third or fourth grade or fifth grade, and she becomes a leader, but then she's too bossy and cruel, and she becomes controversial. We all know two very famous girls like that from cartoons. One is Lucy in Peanuts, and the other is in Rugrats. It's Angelique. Her name isn't coming to me. It will in a second.
Yeah. And likewise, there's in the Powerpuff
Angelica.
Girls.
Angelica, yeah. the bossy girl.
Yeah.
And if you are if you're too bossy. Is there one in the Powerpuff?
Well, the Powerpuff Girls, there's one who's very sweet, and then there's one who's got it all together, and then there's one who's got some problems, and I guess I would describe her as controversial.
Right.
I never thought of it that way before.
Right.
But.
That's her, the controversial girl. It's one who has a lot of power but doesn't manage it very gracefully. You know, just because kids are popular or just because they have attractive traits doesn't mean they know how to be leaders. And in fact, rising to the top of the heap, being the queen bee in fifth grade, can be so exhilarating, but as with power and adults, it can sometimes be corrupting.
Mm-hmm. And finally, the kids that are in the category with the label rejected.
Well, rejected kids come in two flavors, and we all know them, and teachers all know them. They're and these are, again, John Cooey's categories. A rejected submissive, those head-down kind of kids who just come in the morning to school, nobody greets them, they slide along the wall hoping nobody will notice that they don't have a friend to greet them, and they sit down and try and keep their head down so they're under everybody's radar. But still, if they're assigned to work with a group, a more high-status kid will say, I don't want to work with him, he's a jerk. And they just take it. But the problem is they're very prone to depression. And rejected aggressive kids are kids who may have been too aggressive and a bit scary in their social style in the beginning. And then the group starts to reject them, and they can't stand the rejection. They become provocateurs. And they're always pulling down the pillars of the temple, and the roof collapses on them. Now, these are the kids that are most misunderstood because they're often socially rejected. But parents think they're bullies.
Mm-hmm.
They think they're the class bully. And in fact, what they're doing is they're teasing and poking the group, and the group is very often teasing and poking them. I mean, the group will often torment a rejected aggressive kid until they blow up, and then everybody says, well, he's crazy, you know.
Mm. Interesting. Dr. Michael Thompson is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his new book, Best Friends, Worst Enemies, Understanding the Social Lives of Children. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Social skills and friendship are connected, but in the book you note that they're not the same. But I'm wondering if it would be fair to say that each leads to the development of the other.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah.
And that's, mean, kids with better social skills make more friends more easily. And it is a case of the rich get rich and the poor get poorer. Children with better social skills then make more friends and have more social interactions, so they are honing their social skills. Kids with poor social skills have difficulty making friends, and then they're left out of this really crucial peer learning that Willard Hartup from the University of Minnesota talks about, where kids are teaching each other, helping each other develop moral values, giving each other sexual socialization, teaching each other to modulate aggression, and teaching each other effective communication. And whenever I talk to parents about these things, that's not an intuitive list, that your children teach each other effective communication or moral values, you know. Parents think, aren't we doing that?
Mm-hmm.
But the moment you meet a child who isn't able to communicate with their peers effectively, or doesn't use kid words, sounds like a little professor, you look at this kid and you think, what can I do for you? You were supposed to learn this from your peers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Your other kids were supposed to teach you how mm-hmm. to be a kid. I'm an adult, I don't know how.
And a lot of that learning goes on between these little peers, maybe all of it, in play, right?
In play and in everyday business.
Business, okay.
Well, I mean, the business of getting along in a group. My daughter came home in fourth grade, and she'd said something. She'd made a joke at the expense of one of the social leaders in fourth grade, and that the joke, I don't know what it was, but it fell absolutely flat and was taken in the wrong spirit. She'd written a note or something, and she came home. She was very worried that she had annoyed everybody, and she sat down with the class list and called every child and checked and apologized and made it right with her peers. And we didn't teach her how to do that. And probably if we would have said it's not that important, forget it. But she, you know, she's learning. If you annoy the group, then you've got to curry favor and you've got to do that stuff. Those are that skill building for how to get along politically in the world.
Mm. Also, at a very young age, kids are doing in play. They're putting on little plays almost, where they interact with one another.
Yes.
And they do a give and take, and they do like a little dance.
Absolutely. And one of the sweetest times in I think all of life is that absorbing play of childhood, where you get kids by age three, they're able to set aside their own individual neediness and greediness to be able to play. So if one person wants to be the bride and the other is willing to be the groom, you know, even if it's two little girls playing, they're playing wedding. And they will play in the most absorbed, timeless way. I think it's really enviable. But it takes work, and it takes setting aside one's neediness, as I said. And after a while, it may break down. You know, you have two little girls playing upstairs, and then they've been playing for an hour and a half in the most peaceful way, and all of a sudden they appear in the kitchen, and one says,
yeah.
You know, I don't like her, or if she says I always have to be the groom, she gets to be the bride, or I have to be the baby, she gets to be the mommy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the inexperienced parent thinks, oh, I have to wade into this and make it right. And the experienced parent says, oh, can I get you girls some juice? You know, can I just give the egos a rest, and then they'll very often be able to get back up on that play plateau and play again. And then by the end of the afternoon, they're not capable of it. They need to be home and in contact with their parents because they can't sustain it. It is a developmental achievement to be able to play that way.
Yeah, it's work.
Yes, the best kind.
Yeah. Well, outside of that wise parent saying, girls, how about a glass of juice? On their own, left to their own, how do kids learn to negotiate conflicts that arise in play and in friendship?
Well, they do through trial and error, through what works, a strategy that works and a strategy that falls flat. Being endlessly bossy is a strategy that drives other children away, even though it might work with some children in the short term. And they learn that, so they modify their method. If you never speak up for yourself, you may learn that you never get to play the games you want, so you learn how to be a little more assertive. And most kids learn this through a process of give and take. And through even through the very tough years, grades 4 through 8, in middle school, kids are learning important lessons about loyalty, about the true meaning of friendship, about treachery, about the power of the group, all things that we need to learn. And teachers don't really teach, and parents don't really teach. I mean, there's no specific curriculum for this stuff. Kids learn it from one another, and it's painful learning sometimes. The problem is, as parents, we'd like our children to learn the lessons, but we don't want them to have the pain. And we also get sucked in because our own memories of painful social interactions come back to us.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes without sort of taking a step back and thinking about the situation, we rush in with, you know, some kind of pale advice like take a turn or, you know, rather than trying a fresh approach.
Well, when a group is really stuck, maybe saying, have you guys thought of taking turns? Maybe that will help them to come up with a strategy. Sometimes, you know, if two boys are fighting over who gets the Death Star, you know, then you set the timer and you say, well, you get it for 10 minutes and you get it for 10 minutes. But usually by the time the timer has gone off, they've already solved it themselves and moved on to something else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, in the book you say that friends, kids act as coaches for one another.
Yes. Yes, particularly in the years 7 to 12. The friends are coaching each other about how to survive the rigors of group life in school. Mm-hmm. You know, what's cool and how are we doing and what's permissible for boys and what's permissible for girls.
Let me share a little anecdote that someone here at work told me. Two girls, ages 6 and 7, they're very good friends. One is in the first grade and the other is in the second grade. Outside of school, these two are inseparable, but in school, it is not cool for second graders to be friends with first graders.
Absolutely not. what can I say?
Now, isn't it interesting, though, that these two keep to the group's rule in school? They only give one another like a little a nod or an acknowledgement
right in
the hallway. But outside of school, when there aren't other classmates around, the rule is gone.
And so it is also with friendships across gender. My daughter had a boy in the neighborhood whom she played with most weekends when she was in third or fourth grade, but she never invited him to her birthday parties. She only invited girls. She would never have invited him. And if I said, you know, he's your friend, she said, no, Dad, you know, he just lives in the neighborhood.
He's okay for a boy.
Right, exactly.
So at what point do we, you know, in our young lives begin to, you know, feel the pressure of the group? I mean, at ages 6 and 7, that seems, well, I even talked about it earlier, didn't I, in kindergarten?
Oh, it's long since in place.
Yeah.
You know what the group approves of and disapproves of when you're 4 and 5. And we're all susceptible to the power of the group. Why? Because we're social animals, all primates. Live in groups, human beings live in groups, and the group is real important to us, and we don't want to do anything that throws the group off. There's a famous experiment by Solomon Ash. This is from the mid-50s. It's a sort of landmark study in social psychology that Solomon Ash did at Haverford College. He advertised for undergraduates to participate in an experiment on visual perception, except it wasn't. It was on social influence. And he'd have a young man come to the psychology lab in the afternoon, introduce him to six other kids whom he said were also subjects in the experiment. They weren't. They were the experiment. And they'd sit and look at slides of geometric figures for 10 minutes. Everybody seeing the same thing. Then all of a sudden he threw two lines up there, two parallel lines that weren't quite even in length. Your eyes told you they're close to being even, but not even. And he'd start with the kids who were in on the experiment and say, what do you see? And they'd say, they're even. Even, 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 even. And they get right down to our young man, what do you see? And a majority of the time, our 20-year-old undergraduate, bright, intelligent young man says even, even though his eyes are telling him uneven. And when they were interviewed later, they'd say, didn't you see they were uneven? Of course I did. How did it feel to say they were even? Well, it felt weird. Why'd you do it? Well, everybody else had said they were even. And I didn't know why, but I just didn't. You know, I've told that research, a piece of research, to so many kids. And an eighth grade boy said to me once, that guy said even. And I said, well, how'd you know that? And he said, well, I've done things like that. And I said to this eighth grade, well, why? And a girl raised her hand. She said, because he wanted to be a member of the Even Line Club. Well, there it is. We all want to be a member of the Even Line Club. And I don't know about you, Celeste, but if I'm going to a party and I don't know the people very well and I don't know if the men there are going to be wearing coat and tie, I call and find out, because I don't want to be the only one with coat and tie if nobody else has one, or the only one without it if everybody has it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you feel weird being different. And it's that feeling. We are social, and we are conforming animals to a certain extent. It's not that we don't have moral principles, but the group is very powerful.
Yeah. Well, of course, there are times that, you know, being with the Even Line group is fine, but then there are times when, you know, you've got to say, well, I'm sorry, but what I see is a shorter line there.
Right. And about a third of the time, people say that.
Hmm.
But it's very hard when you have a shaky identity, when you're not so grown up and sure of yourself, and you're in eighth grade, and your clique is moving one way, and you know it's wrong. But it's very hard to stand up and say no.
Yeah. You outline in Best Friends, Worst Enemies, laws of group life. Maybe
right.
You'd share those five rules with us.
Well, I've, in a sense, been talking about one, which is that you have to be a part of the group.
Mm-hmm.
It's just essential that you be part of a group. Now, people will tell me, no, my child doesn't seem to care. And yes, there are some children where it's enough just to be in a classroom and part of a school. They don't really need a tighter affiliation. But most kids need to be affiliated. And then you have to figure out whether you're up or you're down. Where are you? You get rank ordered in a group, and you wish for a higher rank than you have, and you worry if you're lower down than you want to be. But most people make peace with where they're put in the pack. What you want to be is in and not out, and you're willing to do things to keep from being thrown out of the group. And one of the things that makes a group cohere is the very fact that we are who we are. Do you remember in the book I said, whenever I go to Texas, people say where they recognize I don't have a Texan accent. They say, where are you from? And I say, Massachusetts. And they say, Massachusetts, that's a nice place. We're very friendly down here in Texas. Right? Which is a very sweet in Texas way to say, we hear you're not so friendly up in Massachusetts. But then you're defining an us and a them. And the rules of group life are very often it's us and them. And then sometimes it's us against them. And very often that ends up in the place that the humans find themselves in all too often, which is we're better than them.
Yeah.
They're different from us and worse. You know, we're Serbs, they're Croats. We're Croats, they're Muslims. Right? We're Hutus, they're Tutsis. And we see all of that in kids struggling to form a group identity. My co-author Catherine had this wonderful clique of girls whom she interviewed for 2 years. And the transcripts of their struggling to define themselves as good but exclusive are really funny, where they'd say, well, we're like not the most snobby clique. We're like the second snobby clique, but the first snobby clique is really snobby. We're not snobby. They all have to dress alike. We don't have to. We're individuals. But sometimes you run into your friend and she's dressed just like you, and it's so amazing. It's great, you know? And, you know, the us and the them is unfortunately, or it just is, human. And we struggle with it because some of our worst behavior comes from believing that our group is different and superior. And that's what a clique is in middle school.
Yeah.
It's just a group of friends
yeah.
who are wonderful for each other, but then they can become devaluing of others.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, something that comes through in a couple of different ways in the book is how kids at that age are rehearsing. I guess we're all rehearsing from very early on, but we're trying things on, like, who am I? Am I okay? Am I more like this? Am I more like that? Especially in that stage of adolescence when you talk about, I think you talk about this in the book in terms of how girls will share clothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. And, sure. Well, Eric Erickson said, long before I was around, said, all adolescent conversation is about identity. And one of the reasons you're in a group is kind of to try everybody else's identity out for yourself. Is this me? Is this group me? And a man told me, actually a reporter for People magazine once said, that he got to a high school, he was new in town, and he fell in with some kids who were the Dungeons and Dragons crowd. And he sat with them at lunch for about a month, and he realized he'd been pegged. Everybody now saw him as a Dungeons and Dragons kid, and he didn't want to be, didn't feel that was his fundamental identity. And one day he got up and changed tables in the dining room, got up and left the group he was with and walked across the dining room and sat down with some athletes. And he said the whole dining room got quiet. Everybody was so socially aware that somebody changing places like that, saying, no, I'm going to have a little identity change right here. You know, everybody registered it. But he said once he did it, he was able to move between the two groups. But he was almost trapped in an identity group. High school, middle school is cliques. High school is identity groups. College, bless it, finally gets much better. As we grow older, there is more social fluidity and a stronger sense of identity. So we're not as trapped in a group as we are. The problem is you can't say to your fourth grader, honey, I know it's tough now, but it'll be great in college. I heard this guy on the radio say that. I mean, it seems endless and sometimes life and death to kids in middle school.
Yeah. I think all of us, if we think back when we step into the cafeteria for the first time in high school, it's like, wow.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, you know, you do kind of, when you're, I think in those first few days as a freshman, you're able to move around a little bit. But then once things get set up, they're pretty well set up.
Yeah. Well, there are two movies that kids, one is a cult movie that teenagers rent called Heathers. Do you know that one?
Yeah.
That has a cafeteria scene, which is bone-chilling, about these three very popular cruel girls called Heather Number 1, Heather Number 2, and Heather Number 3, and how they torment other kids. And the other is Welcome to the Dollhouse, which has a scene of a very low-status girl, a kind of a homely girl, going into a middle school cafeteria. They're both very painful scenes, but everybody who sees them resonates with them because we all had a piece of that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Urbana on line 1. Good afternoon.
Did your research show any predominant trends as to whether you can predict whether a kid's going to use drugs or not? And I'll hang up and listen.
We know that kids, I'm not a researcher. I'm an interpreter and popularizer of other people's research. We know that kids who are socially at the bottom of the heap in their search for friends may run with deviant groups just to be in a group, and that puts them at higher risk for a drug use and alcohol use and other kinds of reckless activity. Your life is saved in school by having a good friend who likes you for who you are, and you don't have to do those kinds of behaviors in order to keep that friendship. It's what you want is a friend who likes you for you, but if you're desperate for friendship, you may run with the drug crowd.
Interesting. Other calls are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Michael Thompson, he's a clinical psychologist, one of the authors of Best Friends, Worst Enemies, Understanding the Social Lives of Children. And we've got another call coming in on line 1 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
At one point you said that it can be life or death, and there was a slight chuckle, but, you know, it's very, very serious. It can be life or death, and it can be When I was in high school, as far as I was in a small high school, about 500 kids in the whole school, and there was a suicide in the class. And the thing that within, you know, hours after it became known, everybody's talking about it, and everybody said, well, I didn't know her. I don't think I know who she is. I don't remember her. And then we realized nobody knew her.
Right.
And she had no friends. And she wasn't an outcast. Nobody knew, said they hated her. Nobody thought that she was an awful person. But nobody knew her.
Yes. Either profoundly neglected or rejected, submissive, that she was so low profile that she was just hoping not to be noticed, but inside desperately lonely and needing to be noticed.
I'm sure she must have been.
This is a very, very common and leading reason for teenagers to suicide, is feeling that they're socially unpopular or left out of it. And for a teenager, that they can think, well, it's always going to be this way. There's no chance for me. And that would drive them towards suicide.
Mm-hmm.
It's one reason why I'm against such big schools as we have in high school, because I think it's important that people feel accountable for what's happening to children socially. And it's hard in high schools of 2,500. We need to know who's at the bottom and whether they're suffering a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I can't stay on the line, but I would appreciate if you could direct more of the conversation towards bullying. That's a topic I'm interested in.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
We talk about bullying, best friends, worst enemies, but I have an opinion, which is that the media talks endlessly about bullying, and parents hear the word bully and they think, well, that's not my child. My child isn't a bully. And so we talk about social cruelty because children exercise enormous power over each other, and some of the children who do are the attractive, popular kids. My daughter went to a new school in sixth grade. She came home the second day and said, Dad, I hate Susie. Everybody says she's a total jerk. And I said, who's everybody? And she named the two most popular girls in the class. And I said, Joanna, you can't be mean to Susie. You hardly know her, and you've judged her already based on other people's words. And she said, okay, Dad, I won't be mean to her, but I can't, like, be her friend. Because I'm new in the school, I at least have to have a shot at being popular. It's a tough moment for a parent when you realize that the group is telling your child whom they can befriend or not.
Mm-hmm.
And Susie was quite friendless because the very most popular kids in the class deemed that she should be friendless. It wasn't until halfway through seventh grade that my daughter was able to claim this girl in some ways as a friend, because she got tired of one of the popular girls and one of the other ones left. A lot of the bullying, people think, wow, it's the loudmouth, swaggering bully, you know, kind of the Matt Dillon character in My Bodyguard, to quote another old movie, and that's a bully. But the truth is, the power is in the hands of the popular kids, and they can use it wonderfully well, or they can use it in ways that are extraordinarily cruel.
Let's talk with another listener on line 2 in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I have 4 daughters and 1 son. And one of my younger daughters was in elementary school until this year. And for the last 3 years in elementary school, the 2 popular girls said, we're not going to be friends with her.
Right.
And did anyone be friends with her? And we couldn't understand it. She was a very nice little girl. And finally what they did was they said, she's gay. Well, she was 9 years old.
Right.
And they couldn't figure out what to say about her. Said she was gay. And now we've moved on to middle school, and thank God, even though those 2 little girls are still there, she has made new friends.
Yes.
But I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. Should I stop worrying? I'm afraid that they're going to infect the new girls.
Well, they may not be as powerful in the middle school now. This is a classic kind of story of 2 girls using their power in a cruel way. And, you know, gay or faggot or lesbian or wimp or wuss, all of which attack kids in the same place, is the number one insult in schools in every state. And kids use this because they understand that adults don't always react to the word in a way they should, which is in a moral way. And so they use gay to attack one another. And it has no meaning at nine, you're quite right to say.
It was a horrible experience.
I bet it was horrible. I bet it was horrible, and I've had many kids tell me this. What I love is that the story has a happy ending.
So far, so good.
If your daughter has a couple of good friends, those two popular kids almost certainly cannot drive a wedge between your daughter and those friends now.
Okay.
They will probably not have that power in middle school, but I can hear how jumpy you are based on the bad years
you had. The past, one of the movies I want to suggest is The Breakfast Club.
Yes.
Because I thought that did it beautifully.
Yes.
Putting
again,
the kids
from all levels of high status to low status.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I guess here's an instance where we go from a smaller setting to a larger setting, and it's good for this little girl, because those two girls that tried to push her off into a corner, they don't have as much power in the larger setting.
And it's interesting, though I favor smaller schools, when I'm called to a really tough situation with a rejected child in a small private school, and they've been at the bottom for 2 years, I counsel them to send that child to a larger school where there's a bigger pool of people available to her to be her friends. And that can be a miracle cure. But sometimes for a lonely, lost child in a big school, the cure is to go to a smaller setting. So you have to, that's a case-by-case fix.
Yeah. In the book, you say that the number one social problem pre-kindergarten through the 12th grade is exclusion.
That's right.
And you say an ongoing discussion about moral standards is important.
A school has to stand against exclusion. And I was very influenced by Vivian Paley's book, You Can't Say You Can't Play, where she said she got tired of the social power that some of her kindergartners exercised over others. She put up the rule on her classroom wall, you can't say you can't play. Now, she said, did I stop exclusion in kindergarten? Not entirely, but whenever kids started to exclude each other, the other kids had a rule to use. You can't say you can't play. And it started a moral discussion about exclusion, and it made her kindergarten a safer place. Up and down the line, schools have to say that tolerance, acceptance, and inclusivity must be central. You know, we require children to go to school. They have to spend their days there. To force them to go to places where they are going to be constantly excluded and no adult stands up and says this is wrong is, I think, wrong. Morally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no adult would go to a workplace where the fellow worker said, oh, she's a dork, I won't work with her. Or they moved their chair away, I wouldn't sit at lunch. I mean, as an adult, we'd get another job. We'd find another workplace. Kids can't get up and move.
They've got to have a sense of security, of some emotional safety and physical safety as
right.
well.
Right, and if a teacher lets the alpha dog in a class, alpha dog boy, mock or have contempt for kids' answers, and the teacher doesn't stand up to him, then all the kids in the class think, well, the cool kids rule it here.
Yeah.
It's not safe. It's not safe to talk. It's not safe to take a guess. You're going to be mocked. That's why teachers have to create a moral classroom where everybody is safe.
I think that also goes for extracurricular activities and the school bus.
Yep.
What can parents do?
Well, parents should support their children's friendships and forget about popularity. Now, unless you think your child's at the bottom, then you make an alliance with the school, maybe get your child into a friendship group or a social skills group, or if they're already kind of depressed and shaky, into individual therapy. But social skills group's more important for this kind of issue. But for the most part, parents should be like lifeguards at a pool and stand by and watch and let the kids swim, and you stop them from running on the wet tile, right?
Right.
But generally, you don't have to go in and save many kids who are drowning when you're a lifeguard. It's your presence that makes the kids behave within kind of appropriate limits. So you supervise, you monitor, and then you rescue the kids who are drowning.
We're out of time. So much more to talk about. I really want to thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Michael Thompson has been our guest this afternoon. He's a clinical psychologist. He's one of the authors of Best Friends, Worst Enemies, Understanding the Social Lives of Children. The book is published by Ballantine Books, and Dr. Thomas's co-authors are Catherine O'Neill Grace and Lawrence Cohen.